welcome back. Our third speaker this afternoon is Jacob Brandes, who's the Director of Graduate Studies in the Physics Department at Harvard University. And he's going to be speaking to us today on a mystery topic. At least what we last heard was that it was a lesson from the minimal modal interpretation of quantum theory. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Brandes.
Thank you all. Thanks again to Elisa and to the center. I really appreciate being here. So my talk is called Lessons from the Minimal Modal Interpretation of Quantum Theory. This is, as I'll explain, a proof of principle interpretation that I worked on with a collaborator, David Kagan, at UMass Dartmouth. There's some archive papers associated with this. But let me get started. I like this quotation. It comes from The Space Child's Mother Goose. If you don't know of it, it's a lovely little book filled with limericks and poems inspired by math and physics. The quantum is only a tittle or jot on a little theory hangs a lot, and I think we can all agree on that. This is the outline of my talk. I'll start with an introduction. I'll explain the motivations and basic structure of this interpretation I'm talking about. And for reasons that will become clear from the introduction, I'm going to make a brief foray into classical probability theory, its interpretation and its structure. And then we'll move on to quantum theory, and then interpreting quantum theory. We'll identify what in some ways is a central problem of interpreting quantum theory and the various approaches and how they address it. And finally, a conclusion and takeaways, including what I call a Vonnegut list for reasons I may have time to explain. So as you all know, science famously suffers from a theory underdetermination problem, by which we mean that too many theories can fit any given set of data. Usually this means that you rely axiomatically on some principle, Occam's razor, Bayesian inference, what have you, to favor one theory over the others. Quantum theory is sometimes said to suffer from an interpretation underdetermination problem, which is a different notion. This is the idea that there are too many interpretations that fit the same theory. I would argue that the danger is precisely the opposite. There may be an overdetermination problem. And the reasoning being that all the present interpretations of quantum theory, when pushed, come up unsatisfactory. Flaws and shortcomings, examples, an absence of a clear ontology, maybe that's not a problem for you, but then inscrutability, conceptual vagueness, mathematical incompleteness, conflict with relativity, tension with our experience of probability, inconsistency with experiment, profusion of epicycles, or too many ad hoc assumptions. So if there's one overarching goal of this MMI, minimal modal interpretation that I've been working on with my collaborator, and I may accidentally say we instead of I. I don't actually mean the royal we here. I actually mean we because there's two of us who are working on this. But just a proof of principle. If we can show that one interpretation navigates all these problems, then we can show there is not an interpretation overdetermination problem after all in quantum theory. But again, we had to navigate a very narrow gauntlet of constraints that have arisen over the past century. And we learned a lot of lessons along the way that we believe are of general relevance to quantum foundations work in the future. If there's an overarching lesson for the talk, and we'll come back to this, it's that in some sense traditional approaches to quantum theory obscure what's really different about it. And partly it's because there's so many exotic ingredients that are introduced simultaneously that have no classical counterparts. For example, state vectors, wave functions, computing probabilities from absolute value squares of complex amplitudes, the Schrodinger equation, Hilbert spaces. Also, this makes it very difficult to teach the subject. I had an occasion last summer to try to teach quantum mechanics to high school students, and you don't want to start with Hilbert spaces. It's very hard to do that. It's not only more natural to work at a more general level, but for reasons I'll explain, there are other nice reasons for that. So the purpose of this talk is to begin by reformulating the set theoretic picture of classical probability theory, with its notion of sample spaces, events, probability functions, in an algebraic language, the language of random variables. Now, I don't want to condescend anybody. I'm sure many of you are really great at math. But those of you who are a little math phobic, don't worry. The math will be easy, by which I mean it's just sets, arithmetic, algebra, and almost no calculus. So the algebraic language, I'll argue, is far more analogous to quantum theory and greatly clarifies the precise similarities and differences between classical and quantum theory, as well as suggesting, as I'll explain, new ways to classify and constrain interpretations of quantum theory. And as I said before, there are other benefits. In particular, this alternative reformulation is more general. It can handle open systems as well as closed ones. So now, with that as motivation, let me talk about classical probability theory. Now, in classical probability theory, your interpretation is, to some extent, up to you. You can be a realist, meaning you think that there's really a world out there, an instrumentalist. We're just applying algorithms to compute probabilities and empirical results. So I'll present a table here with the basic ingredients seen from the two perspectives. There's the sample space. I call it omega. I call an element of that x. That's one element of the sample space. And the realist would say this is the set of mutually exclusive states x of the system, the states of being. Instrumentalists would say these are just the mutually exclusive, fine-grained, elementary measurement outcomes. So for the realist, this is what we would say defines the ontology, the possible states of being of the system. And each X is an ontic state, a state of being. The system is in that state. An event is a subset of the sample space and represents a collection of ontic states in the realist picture or a generalized measurement outcome from the instrumentalist picture. And finally, probabilities, the probability distribution, which can be assigned to the individual elements or maybe generalized sets of elements. These are epistemic probabilities in the realist point of view. They represent what we know about the system. In the instrumentalist point of view, they're just empirical outcome probabilities, the empirical probabilities we expect for outcomes. So again, from the realist point of view... Yeah.
By state, do you definitely mean instant of time, or state could be a process?
I mean it an instant in time, and I'll elaborate that in a moment. I'll come back to that. It's a good, very good question. I will come back to that. So, and here we mean the system's epistemology, what we know about it, what we know about the underlying state of the system, and we'll refer to the probability distribution as a whole in this picture to the epistemic state, the state of our understanding, in contrast to the ontic state X of its being. So the structure of classical probability theory. Well, there's that set theoretic structure, but now I'm going to introduce this alternative algebraic language. We begin with the notion of a random variable. Some of you may know what this is. So it represents a quantity F whose value is uncertain. I put a little caret on top to indicate that this is a random variable and not just a single number. There are two equivalent definitions of a random variable. The intuitive definition is it's a list of possible outcomes, F, labeled by which fine-grained elementary outcome we got in the measurement. So F may not be, the different F of X's may not be distinct. It could be that two different elementary outcomes, X, lead to the same observed result for F. And each of these has a corresponding probability P of X of occurring. Or we can think of it as a real or complex valued function that takes in as a mapping points X in sample space and spits out a real or complex number. Once you have random variables, you can add them together, and the result is a new random variable whose outcomes are just the sum of the previous outcomes. You can multiply them. You can multiply them by a constant number, a C number, to get a new random variable. However, not every random variable has a multiplicative inverse, that is, another random variable, when you multiply it by the first, you get one, because if there's a single outcome for which the random variable is zero, then there is no multiplicative inverse, because zero times nothing can be one. Together with all these properties, we say that the set of random variables forms an algebra, which roughly speaking is a commutative ring under addition in the sense of a vector space with a multiplication operation. So we obtain an algebraic formulation of classical probability theory, which is convenient for calculations at the cost of being more abstract and downplaying the ontology. We need one more, we'll get to that in a moment, but some examples. There's the identity random variable, the random variable that's just always true. Its value is always 1, meaning true, and you multiply any other random variable by it, and you get the original random variable. There are projectors. Given a generalized outcome, a subset of the sample space, a collection of fine-grained outcomes, we can ask, was E true? And that defines a random variable whose value is 1 if X belongs to E, or 0 otherwise. But we can also think of this as a conditional probability. Given that the fine-grained outcome is X, what's the probability that E is the outcome? And that is only true if X belongs to E. I'm going to do something a little unorthodox now. I'm going to introduce a random variable to represent the probability distribution itself. And you can loosely think of this as the question, what was the probability of getting the outcome that I got? And that's a random variable whose outcomes are just the probabilities themselves. So this is very useful. And finally, the surprisal. The surprisal is a function that interpolates between being infinitely surprised to get a result whose probability was 0 and 0 getting a result whose probability was 1. So again, the final ingredient we'll need to complete this algebraic formulation is the notion of the trace operation. So this is just a linear function that takes a random variable f, which is not a number, it's a list of numbers, but it takes that random variable to a number, the sum of its outcomes. So here, trace of f is just the sum over all the fine-grained outcomes of f, and it just gives you a number in the real or complex numbers. Now, notice that there could be multiplicities here. If f is multiply represented among different fine-grained outcomes, certain outcomes could be represented multiple times, that's fine. And now we'll see as we can reformulate the interesting questions about set theoretic probability theory in the language of random variables. The trace of the identity operator is just a sum of 1 over all elementary outcomes, and it counts the size. That's the size notation, the number of elements in omega, it's cardinality. The normalization of our probability distribution is the sum of all the probabilities, which is 1, and that's just the trace of rho. That's the Greek letter rho, by the way. Expectation values, that is weighted average values of probability of random variables weighted by the probability distribution, are just trace of rho f. And probabilities themselves, you can think of as the expectation value of the question, did I get E? And so they're given by trace of rho projector onto E, which we can think of in a Bayesian sense. That's the first equation. Probability of getting E given X times the probability of X summed over all possible X's. But that's equivalent to the sum over all probabilities of X's that belong to the generalized outcome. And finally, if we want to gauge how certain we are about the probability distribution as a whole, we would say, what is our average surprisal? Our average surprisal is on average how surprised we are by the answer. And that defines the entropy function, which is zero when we know the exact answer, and maximum when we have a uniform probability distribution and don't know what the answer is. I want to say something about pure probability random variables, and here's what I mean. We could imagine the case of a trivial probability distribution in which the probability is one to get a certain outcome and zero otherwise. Okay. Probability random variable at the level of random variables is characterized by being idempotent. That's just the fancy statement that if you square it, you get itself, and that's because its outcomes are one or zero, and one or zero are the unique finite numbers that if you square them, you get the same number again. It's straightforward to show that this probability distribution leads to a vanishing entropy as expected. There's no uncertainty about the results. But note, this is always a measure zero idealization. That is, it requires infinite precision to be able to say that a probability distribution is exactly trivial. That's never realized in practice. More generically, we say that the random variable is mixed. So what really occurs in probability theory is you have a system which is really a composite system consisting of two subsystems, A and B, those are the capital letters. And so each X, each state of the system, is really a specification of little a for big A and little b, a state little b for subsystem B. And the way we say this in mathematics is the sample space for the composite system is our Cartesian product. It's a fancy way of saying that every X is of the form A and B, where you specify A and B for the two subsystems. A random variable for the composite system generically depends both on A and B, and we represent this by saying that f of x is really a function of a and b, and so is p of x. Now, given a composite system, we can introduce a formalism for taking random variables on the composite system and reducing them to just the subsystem. We just sum over the other variable, so by definition we get a function that depends just on the subsystem A, which is now a random variable by definition on subsystem A. This is constrained by the requirement that when you trace over A and B, you ought to get the full trace. And you do. If you sum over A and B, you get the sum over all X's, and that's what we meant as the trace. And in this language, we can represent the reduced or marginal probability distribution for A alone, which follows from the Bayesian law of total probability. The probability for just A alone of getting little a is the probability of A regardless of B, and we write that as the sum of the probability distribution for A and B summed over B. But in the language of random variables and probability random variables, this is the partial trace over rho. These formulas are identical. So now I'm going to set up a dictionary between the set theoretic picture of classical probability theory and the algebraic picture. Generalized outcomes, remember, those correspond to subsets of the sample space, collections of fine-grained outcomes. They correspond to projectors. To say that we got a result not in a generalized outcome is to say that we got it in the complement. And the language of random variables, this is 1 minus the projector for E. The intersection of two generalized outcomes is the set of all states that belong to both of them, for which they're both true. And that corresponds to the random variable that is 1 only when they're both true, and that's the product of PE and PF. Now, we can imagine we have a collection of generalized outcomes indexed by a label I with a property that no two of them share any elements in common. This is phrased, they're mutually exclusive. It's phrased in the language that their intersection is the empty set. In the language of projectors, we see the right-hand side, we see the projectors vanish when you multiply them together, unless they're the same, in which case we get the original projector again. So projectors themselves are also idempotent. But we also, to say that a generalized outcome, collection of generalized outcomes are complete, is to say that they cover the sample space. Every element of the sample space is in one of them, meaning their union is the whole sample space. And the language of random variables is a statement if you sum over all of the corresponding projectors, you get a tautological statement. At least one of them is true, and only one of them is always true, and that means that you get one. Now, of course, we're interested in making observations, considering observables. An observable in the set theoretic picture is a list of outcomes, maybe not all distinct, and we label the distinct outcomes by a little letter lambda. To each observable, there is a corresponding collection of events and projectors. E lambda is the set of all x for which lambda x is the distinct outcome lambda, and there's a corresponding projector for that. And these are complete in the same sense, that distinct outcomes have zero overlap. And if we ask what outcome did we get among all outcomes, tautologically we get one. Now, this algebra of random variables has a basis. At the very least, we can express every random variable as a sum of the so-called elementary projectors, the projector that I get fine-grained outcome X. And every random variable in this story can be represented as a sum over these elementary projectors times a number f of X. Moreover, every observable satisfies an eigenvalue equation with distinct outcomes and projectors. This is often not how we think about classical probability theory, the word eigenvalue equation. But here's what I mean. I claim the following statement, where this is the observable in question, these are its projectors, and that's the distinct outcome. And this is just a statement that, to say that, to ask the question, did I get the distinct outcome little lambda? And if I did, what outcome did I get? Is the same thing as saying, did I get the distinct outcome little lambda? And the outcome is little lambda. These are identical statements. Moreover, every observable has a so-called spectral resolution. It's the same thing to say, what value did I get for the random variable as, did I get this value? If so, I got lambda. Did I get that value? If so, I got another lambda. So these are identical statements, and this is how we express it algebraically. We can play this game with the probability random variable itself, which is now treated as a random variable. This is rho, and in general, it has spectral decomposition as well. What outcome did I get? Elementary outcome did I get? And what with what corresponding probability? And in this picture, we see that the epistemology of the story, the probability distribution, is encoded in the coefficients, and the ontology is encoded in these projectors that identify the distinct elementary outcomes. Modal language, bring it back to modality, highlights and clarifies the distinction at work here. So on the one hand, we have epistemology, the epistemic state which corresponds to what's possible for the system, and ontology, the ontic state, what is actually happening with the system. So back to our dictionary, we have probabilities, which again we can compute as expectation values, average truth values. And in the set theoretic picture, we have this Bayesian formula. In the algebraic picture, this is trace rho p, as we explained before. Now, if you do a measurement of big lambda, and you get the distinct outcome little lambda, then you update your probability distribution. There's some new probability distribution, probability of getting x given that I got little lambda in the experiment. And this is given by Bayes' theorem. Right? It's the conditional probability of getting lambda given x times the initial probability distribution for x divided by the initial probability for lambda. But that conditional probability is a projector. And the analogous statement for random variables would be that statement over here. So now we can phrase this updating process in the language of random variables. So, if we're not looking at a probability distribution, if we're not looking at it and there's some system involved and the system can change with time, we can ask, well, if we were to do a measurement later at some time t, what is the probability at t of getting a particular x? And the answer is given by the Bayesian law of total probability. Probability of getting x at a later time t is given by the probability of getting x naught at an earlier time t naught times the conditional probability of getting the x at a later time given x naught at t naught summed over all possibilities x naught. This looks like a linear mapping, but it is not generically a linear mapping. It is not generically a linear mapping because those conditional probabilities, the things appearing with that little bar symbol, they may have a complicated dependence on both the initial epistemic state and maybe other intermediate epistemic states, especially for open systems when there are memory effects. So this is not just a linear mapping of p, x naught, and t naught. When we talk in physics about true dynamics, as opposed to just watching something change in time, usually we have in mind a physical rule that doesn't depend, the rule itself doesn't depend on our knowledge of what's going on with the system. Although, when we average over external systems, maybe interacting with our system, there can be the emergence of stochasticity. In any event, we say that a system has dynamics of nth order if, by going to a sufficiently complicated conditional probability, I can get a mapping in which the conditional probabilities do not depend on epistemic information at all. They are just intrinsic physical facts that connect initial states to later states. And now we have a properly multilinear mapping. I should say, by the way, that classical mechanics is actually a second-order dynamical mapping in this sense. Usually you think, wait, I only need one piece of information. I need to know x and p. But you can think of p as being x at two infinitesimal moments in time. So we need x at a certain moment in time and x at a slightly later moment in time. So in that sense, it's second order. The simplest case is first order or Markovian dynamics. And this is where we're back to this picture we had before. But now we're assuming those conditional probabilities are just physical facts. They only depend on in the realist picture, ontic information. They don't depend on our knowledge of the system. We can now represent this in the algebraic language as saying that rho initial, rho at t naught, is given by some linear function that takes it and spits out a rho at a final time. So how does this all square with our classical deterministic picture? Well, classically deterministically, for every initial state x naught at time t naught, we suppose there is a unique x at a later time such that the conditional probability to go from one to the other is 1, and there's no probability of going anywhere else. Our linear mapping, the sum disappears, and it becomes just the statement that the probability distribution at t naught is 1 when we're at x at t naught, and it's 1 when we're at x at the later time t. If we specialize to infinitesimal time differences, here's the first mention of calculus. Then we get the following statement, in which when we subtract the right-hand side and left-hand side, we get the statement that the total derivative, taking into account both the dependence through the probability distribution, that's after the semicolon t, as well as the dependence through x of t, is 0. We call that information conservation, and the entropy then follows is also conserved. No information is entering or leaving the system. Okay, so let's apply this to the familiar picture of classical mechanics. Here are states, and we can think of classical mechanics as a Markovian system if we regard our state as comprising both x and p. Information conservation implies the famous Liouville equation. For those of you who know what Poisson brackets are, there they are. For those of you who don't, I don't have time to explain them. But just look at the shape of that equation. We'll see that that shape is important. One of the key things, though, is that appearing in this equation, which determines the time evolution, is a function called the Hamiltonian, and usually has the interpretation of the energy of the system in a generalized sense. And this leads, through some very nice arguments going back over half a century from Jaynes, to a nice formulation of the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And this also is nice because it connects this abstract notion of entropy we're talking about to the physical entropy we think about thermodynamics. If I change the internal state of a system, or maybe its external parameters, I can ask, how does the average energy, U, expectation value of H, how does it change? Well, by the product rule of calculus, there are two contributions. The heat, which corresponds to a change in the internal state of the system, and the work, which corresponds to a change in external parameters of the system. That's the famous first law of thermodynamics. What Jaynes showed, he wasn't the first to show this, Gibbs showed this before, and other people as well, is that for a system in equilibrium, the entropy I introduced, that abstract entropy, agrees with the maximum possible entropy the system can have at the given temperature, and also agrees with what you'd experimentally measure, like the Clausius notion of entropy. And so for a system changing in a reversible way to equilibrium, we get a famous relationship between the change in entropy and the heat and the temperature of the system. If we consider a closed system initially at equilibrium at a given temperature, then by the first statement, the experimental entropy is initially equal to what we call the entropy, the information entropy. The system is closed, and so if we allow it to evolve in a closed way, possibly not remaining at equilibrium, but a closed way, then the initial and final information entropies are the same because we argued that entropy is conserved. The final entropy is bounded by the maximum final entropy. And the maximum final entropy of the previous argument is the experimental entropy, and so we obtain a succinct formulation of the traditional second law of thermodynamics for the experimental entropy. Okay, so enough classical mechanics. I've connected everything together to physics, to probability. Now let's talk about quantum theory and the issue of non-commutativity. So there's a game that mathematicians like to play. You start with some kind of set, measure space, a topological space, a vector space, solution space, variety, manifold, what have you. You reformulate that set or space in an algebraic language that captures the interesting features, usually with an algebra in mind, a set of ingredients you can add and multiply. For example, for a topological space, you typically use a commutative ring of functions. For a variety, an algebraic geometry, you use the ideal of a polynomial ring. And then, here's the game. You allow the algebra to be non-commutative and you see what happens. For example, you do this with a commutative ring of functions, it leads to a subject known as non-commutative geometry. So up until now, our formulation of everything has been classical. Let's generalize by dropping the assumption of commutativity. Okay? And let's denote the new kind of random variable we have here by flipping those carrots upside down. So now our random variables will be denoted with a hat instead of a carrot because they're proper and they wear little hats. Now generically, the commutators, meaning fg minus gf, are not assumed always to vanish. They may in special cases, but generically they don't. Fg is not generically equal to gf. And what we're going to attempt to do is leave the algebraic formulation of probability theory otherwise intact, mutatis mutandis. That is, we'll assume the existence of as many ingredients as we can with their familiar properties, and just see how far we can go. We'll assume identity, random variable, probability random variable, observables, speculative compositions, a basis, etc. There's a theorem in group theory called Cayley's theorem, which generalizes very nicely to rings, which is what an algebra is. It's a kind of a ring. And it applied to this context, I'm not going to show you the proof, it's not a very hard proof, but given an algebra of random variables with a basis, with some of the assumptions we've been carrying over, One can show that it has a faithful representation in terms of linear operators acting on vectors in a vector space with a basis of its own. And given a fixed choice of algebra, a fixed choice of what the random variables are, you're free to choose different possible vector spaces, and in the fancy language we call this choosing different representations. You still have to choose what projectors you're going to consider to be valid. You have to commit to what kinds of projectors you're going to allow. When you commit to the standard choice of projectors, you get quantum theory based on Hilbert spaces with a positive definite inner product as a consequence, rather than being put in as an input. Our random variables become linear operators, and in fact people call them operators, or equivalently matrices, and the formal name for this algebra is called a C-star algebra. Non-negativity of probabilities implies that a suitable generalization of the notion of complex conjugation, formally speaking it's complex conjugation transposing, which generalizes complex conjugates to matrices, or linear operators, is the statement that our probabilities are real and non-negative, and that's expressed in these statements. Our density matrix rho, it's not called a density matrix, not a probability random variable, is real. The dagger being equal to itself specifies that all probabilities are real, and bigger than equal to zero says its eigenvalues are all bigger than equal to zero, which is equivalent to the statement that probabilities come out real. The same is true for projectors. And for general observables, the requirement is they commute with their adjoints. In the simpler case where they're self-adjoint, this is trivially satisfied. The non-commutativity immediately leads to some very nice little facts. Classically, this is just classical statistics. You can show that if you take the standard deviation, that's what delta F represents of F, and multiply by the standard deviation of G, then their product of standard deviations is bounded from below by their covariance, which is the expectation value of FG minus the product of their expectation values, and that vanishes if they're independent and the expectation of their product factorizes. In quantum theory, one can show that the covariance is bounded from below by their commutator, and this leads immediately to the uncertainty principle in its general form. So a famous example, X does not commute with P in quantum theory. You plug this in and you get the famous Heisenberg uncertainty principle. An upshot of this is quantum random variables can be uncorrelated only if they commute. The question about when quantum variables can be independent of each other, or what's the minimum requirements to ensure they're independent of each other, is encompassed in the so-called no communication theorem, which establishes when two quantum systems with their own random variables do not evolve in a way that connects them together. Before I can talk about the structure of quantum theory, I need to introduce the last algebraic ingredient we needed, which is the trace operation that converts these abstract random variables to a number. And we're going to proceed, as usual, by going as close as we can to the classical case. We'll require, as in the classical case, that the trace of an elementary projector, meaning a projector that cannot be written non-trivially as the sum of two other projectors with positive coefficients, has trace 1. That's certainly the case for elementary projectors in classical probability theory. And also to ensure well-defined probabilities, if you recall, we had a formula that probabilities are given by trace of rho times a projector. We don't want that formula to depend on the arbitrary order in which we put the projectors, so we'll require that for any pair of operators or random variables, it doesn't matter what order they appear in. Note, this only holds for pairs. This, if you plug in more operators, leads to a slightly more complicated identity called the cyclic identity. We won't need to review that. What this means is that for any observable, you can now show that its trace is given by the sum of the diagonal elements of its matrix. You set the two matrix indices equal to each other and you sum. But if I plug in the spectral decomposition of the random variable instead and use the linearity of the trace operation, we immediately get the right-hand side, which says that the trace is also the sum of the outcomes multiplied by the degeneracies, which is completely in agreement with the classical version of the formula. We also need a partial trace for handling composite systems, and we define it by classic analogy. Linear composes properly to give the full trace. And so we see here we need a random variable defined just on system A, so we set the indices of B equal and sum over B and get a random variable just defined on A. Now I'm in a position, I have a random variable algebraic formulation of both pictures, to really set up a comparison between classical and quantum probability theory. We've got observables, the hats have changed direction, outcomes, although there's no X's in the quantum case, so we'll just refer to this as the matrix elements, but we still have a notion of distinct outcomes when you do a spectral decomposition or ask what you get when you do measurement. The complete sets of projectors are formally the same in both pictures. I've only changed the directions of the hats. If you know what a positive operator-valued measure is, it's a POVM, not going to go into it, but you can define those classically as well, and they both agree on the quantum and classical sides. Eigenvalue equation is the same. Of course, in the quantum case, we're familiar with calling this an eigenvalue equation. And spectral decompositions are also formally the same. Probabilities are calculated in a very similar way, but here we're being a little sneaky because we derive the probability form in the classical side from the probability distribution, from the set theoretic picture. In the quantum theory, we're just porting over the algebra, so the last formula, trace of rho p, is really a definition of how we compute the probabilities, and it's the general Born rule, but in this formulation it looks identical to the classical version. Expectation values come out the same way. We can compute reduced probability random variables. We justified this in the classical case from the Bayesian picture. Again, in the quantum case, it's just our definition of how to get the density matrix of the subsystem. It's called the reduced density matrix. And we have a formal relationship between how we update a probability random variable after a measurement. So notice this is the classical formula I presented before, and I can stick in, if I want, an extra factor of the projector upstairs because everything commutes and projectors are idempotent. In the quantum case, the analogous formula has to have that there because of non-commutativity. Otherwise, you'd run into problems with being self-adjoint. This is the von Neumann-Luders projection, but in this picture, it bears an uncanny resemblance to what we do classically. Entropy comes out the same way, although in the quantum case, we call this the von Neumann entropy. And purity is again phrased in terms of being idempotent. Again, I remind you, this is a measure zero idealization, both classically and quantum mechanically. It corresponds to zero entropy. In the classical case, this means the probability random variable is just one elementary projector. In the quantum case, turns out this means that it corresponds to a state vector psi. Again, this is a measure zero idealization. So, time evolution. Generically, time evolution is no more linear in quantum theory than it is classically. I hate to break it to you. We often make an idealized assumption, however, that a system can be approximated in its dynamics by what is called linear, and the CPTP stands for completely positive trace preserving. It's a formality. It just means that it keeps density matrices. And that it's linear, and this is an identical formula from what we saw in the case of a linear Markovian map in the classical case, that it maps linearly the initial density matrix to the final density matrix. But this is, again, an idealized assumption. It doesn't hold generically for an open system. As an aside, people have taken this and rewritten it in algebraic language in a manner that resembles the Bayesian propagation formula in terms of what are called conditional states. If you know what the channel state duality is, the Choi-Jamiel-Kauskas isomorphism from quantum computing, that's what this is. If you don't worry about it. If we idealize even further by assuming a closed system in deterministic dynamics and move along with the classical analogy, then we say that each basis vector from a basis determines a unique basis vector maybe from some other basis and vice versa. And by the way, the choice of which basis we use here turns out to be completely irrelevant, so it's not dependent on that choice. Then the mapping relating the basis vectors is given by a matrix U. It's a unitary matrix, and the corresponding change in the density matrix is given by sandwiching the density matrix in U and U complex conjugate transpose adjoint. If we apply this to infinitesimal time differences, following the classical case, second appearance of calculus, we get the von Neumann equation. And now if you remember that Louisville equation we wrote down before, this bears a striking resemblance. And again, for a system like this, S is conserved, the entropy is conserved. Question?
Yeah, so maybe you're going to touch on this, but the idealized bit, so when you're assuming it's closed system deterministic dynamics in the quantum case, so your reduced density matrix is always going to be a pure mixture? Is that impure?
I am not assuming. I'll come back to that. It's okay. A very, very good point, but I'll come back to that. This is a very, very good point. Okay. So now I'm going to set up a chart between this general algebraic picture, which may be unfamiliar to those of you who've seen quantum theory, and the sort of pure elementary picture where we assume the idealized case, everything is pure, that's often depicted in textbooks. Probabilities are computed in the mixed picture by trace of rho projector. In the elementary picture, this is the absolute value squared of the wave function, and one can derive the second from the first. That's the original form of the Born rule. Expectation values are obtained in the mixed picture by tracing over rho lambda. In the pure elementary idealized picture, it's obtained by sandwiching the operator between two copies of the state vector. We update measurements in the mixed picture by this analogy to the Bayesian update formula. And you can show that when you assume purity and elementary projectors, this is identical to what we usually think of as collapse of the state vector. And deterministic dynamics, that von Neumann equation for the pure case, becomes the Schrodinger equation, which is a consequence. So what is a central problem that is going on here that's highlighted by this picture that we've constructed now relating these two theories? So one trouble, and this is the main trouble of the talk, is what is happening to the sample space. Classically, you multiply two projectors and you get an AND statement. P PEPF corresponds to PE and F, E intersection F. And in set theory, an intersection of E with F is the same as intersection of F with E. And this implies that these things commute. But quantum mechanically, we don't have commutivity generically. That's an obstruction. Moreover, you could have a complete set of projectors in the sense we talked about it, to get a tautological statement, but it turns out there's an infinite number of different complete sets you can use, and in general, the members of one complete set don't commute with the members of another complete set. Again, giving an obstruction to the straightforward existence of an underlying sample space omega, and thus, in a realist picture, an underlying ontology. In other words, algebra has survived, and set theory has not. In fact, the rest of quantum non-commutativity essentially arises from this non-commutativity of the projectors. Now, mathematicians who do this, they're fine with that. They'll say, all right, set theory is gone, the sample space is gone, we're happy to just do mathematics. This troubles me a little bit, maybe it troubles you. But one nice thing about it is it provides yet one more way to classify the different interpretations that we currently have about quantum theory, in the sense of how they address this obstruction to the existence of an underlying sample space or ontology. So I'm going to make a chart. The columns are what kind of ontology we have. Fundamental, always exists, or emergence. There's only an ontology for macroscopic systems, let's say. The rows will correspond essentially to how many different realizations of an ontic state a system has. Interestingly, there's multiple choices. So in this picture, we'd say instrumentalism, and there's a new instrumentalist-flavored interpretation called cubism. It used to be called quantum Bayesianism, but that's out of vogue now. In which we don't propose any world, so there's no question of fundamental or emergent. We just regard everything as the formalism as in the instrumentalist sense of computing empirical results algorithmically. There are what are called fixed modal interpretations that suppose there is an ontology global for every system that all systems play a part in. De Broglie-Bohm is actually an example of this kind of fixed modal interpretation. GRW is a kind of interpretation in this sense as well. The textbook Copenhagen interpretation, I'm mindful that there's no agreement about what Copenhagen means, but the textbook Copenhagen interpretation you see in books is that there is a definite world, but really only for classical systems macroscopically. And once you go to quantum systems, then that notion of a world goes away. There are various non-commutative approaches as well, where you try to take the random variables that are non-commutative and see in some sense that they emergently produce a commutative overall reality. Now, I make a distinction here between global one-world interpretations and system-centric. System-centric means that each system has a definite ontic state, but they may not sew together across ontic states in some consistent whole, in some obviously reductionistic consistent whole. And examples here are the spectral modal interpretations of like Vermaa and Dieks, as well as the minimal modal interpretation. Among interpretations that say that many things are realized are the perspectival interpretations, which, loosely speaking, for each complete set of projectors, you get a different sample space. And the system has an ontic state in all, one ontic state in all of them simultaneously. And in that sense, every system has many different ontic states across all the different complete sets. In that sense, it's a many worlds kind of interpretation. The traditional many worlds interpretation of Everett and DeWitt is the idea that there is a sample space, but it's only emergent for big systems through some physical process. Well, this is now a slightly different notion of occupying every state, but in that one sample space, every system occupies all of the possibilities. It's a nice little exercise to see where the classical interpretations fit in this picture. You can think of the Newtonian classical picture as a global one-world interpretation, which is a fundamental reality shared by all systems in a global sense. Now, there was a philosopher, Lewis, who had this idea of modal realism, that the way to interpret possibilities in the modality sense is that all possible worlds are, in fact, real worlds. They're all fundamentally there. So I guess you could fit that into the fundamental many worlds picture. So how do the different approaches fit into this picture? Well, again, there's instrumentalism or cubism. Here we regard the formalism as a formal algorithm for obtaining empirical results by agents. This is the shut up and calculate point of view. And what counts as an agent? Well, we can't say in an external way, but within, internally, as a self-consistency condition, using the same formulas, we can say that you're an agent and you're doing successful measurements. If the question, did I get a definite result, comes out true with probability 99.9%, and the question, if I do many results, the statistics match up with the Born rule, also comes out as 99.9%. The many worlds interpretation is radically different. Instead of no worlds being proposed, it proposes all the worlds. And the general way that this works is you single out by some axiom a basis, a set of vectors, forming a complete set of projectors to be your sample space. Maybe you axiomatically require decoherence does this. For some reason, once you've managed to do this, you declare that every ontic state is realized simultaneously. I don't know why. You then declare axiomatically that observers experience all those simultaneous realities probabilistically, according to the Born rule. This is an axiom, although people try to justify it circularly by saying all of the branches of the wave function, the other possibilities where you don't get those frequency ratios, which, mind you, are far more numerous than the ones you do, are somehow negligible because they have small amplitudes, but small amplitudes beg the question because to say that those are improbable is to assume the Born rule. And usually you also declare as an axiom a biggest system enclosing all other systems, evolving unitarily. You call it the universal wave function. Nonetheless, you still get a tension with locality, because what you find is the only way to keep locality manifest is to let the world basis, the only way to keep a sensible branching structure is to require the world basis change in a crazy non-local way. Finally, an important ingredient in every paper about the many worlds interpretation is that no axioms have actually been imposed, and this is really just quantum theory in its rawest form. You literally hear, just say Hilbert space and Schrödinger equation, then stop. Simplest interpretation ever. The de Broglie-Bohm interpretation is a beautiful one-world interpretation. There's a global reality, global sample space, every system has a state, works great non-relativistically. As your definite states, you say that given n particles, the states where every particle is a definite position, those are the ontic states. If you look at the Schrödinger equation, you see that it's mathematically equivalent to the statement that this complex valued wave function moves in an interdimensional, in fact, it's a 3n-dimensional configuration space and guides the particles around exactly to agree with observations. Anyway, it's a beautiful picture. Unfortunately, the picture is destroyed by relativity, utterly destroyed. The first question is how you pick a sample space in the relativistic context. This has been unsolved for over a century, and no one has been able to make significant progress in solving it. The reason why there's not a canonical or preferred choice anymore is the position basis ceases to be orthonormal. There's a small probability for particles to leak out of their light cones quantum mechanically, and this leads to a lack of orthogonality of position states of order the Compton wavelength of the particle. So there's a blurriness to definite position states. At best, you have to use what's called a POVM. I'm not going to explain that. But if you're going to use a POVM, there are other choices you could use, including some that have a more classical interpretation, like coherent states. So again, we have this question of which one do we choose? Some people say, forget particles. Relativity means fields. Let's take the states of definite field configuration as being our ontic states. The problem is that this works for bosonic fields, but fermionic fields don't have numerical value fields. So what do we do with those? There are deeper problems. The de Broglie-Bohm interpretation cannot accommodate non-classical changes of particle spectrum that occur, for example, in quantum field theories and phase transitions, dualities, non-geometric phases of space-time that occur in things like the ADS-CFT duality, etc. The minimal modal interpretation is motivated by the following idea. So if we look at that spectral resolution of the classical probability random variable again, where the P of Xs, the probabilities encode the epistemology, and the projectors encode the ontology, well, there's a similar spectral resolution of the density matrix in quantum theory. And so one might be tempted to give similar interpretations to those pieces there. The minimal modal interpretation says give in to the temptation. Okay. And whatever basis is the eigenbasis for the density matrix, that's your sample space now. There are some subtleties when you consider proper versus improper mixtures, and if you have questions, I can get to that. But one neat thing about this picture is that it allows you to put trajectories and dynamics back into quantum theory for the ontic states. Okay. There have been many attempts to do this, and they all have problems. The way that we do it is if you have a linear mapping, which you may not have exactly, but we're okay with this probabilistic story being somewhat imprecise. If you have a linear mapping, then there is a nice way to introduce conditional probabilities for going from one state to the other at the ontic level. That's the conditional probability that you were in J at T naught, and you ended up in I at T. Miraculously, these probabilities satisfy all the correct Bayesian rules. They're also non-negative, which is not the case for most of the conditional probabilities for ontic states that have been introduced in literature. What's nice is you can also extend this picture to conditional probabilities in more general contexts for multiple systems, as well as between parent systems and subsystems. So, conclusion takeaways, and we'll refer to a couple of the things I mentioned before, as well as other things. This is Kurt Vonnegut. Okay. The reason I call this a Vonnegut list will be clear in a moment. So this is a list of general points that we, my collaborator and I, believe transcend our interpretation in particular, but help motivate it. These are unexamined, entrenched notions that we feel need to be reevaluated or questioned, that any interpretation should be expected to at least address them, not solve them. And my goal is to make you, and I don't mean you because you guys are great, okay? I know you guys aren't going to do this, but to make people in general, maybe I won't stop them, but at least, you know, I'm a parent, I have kids, I make my kids guilty, that's one form of persuasion, at least make you, in the abstract sense, a little guilty next time you mention them. Because seeing these repeated every time looks like we haven't made progress, and we have. Why is this called the Vonnegut List? Kurt Vonnegut was on The Daily Show like 10 years ago. It was shortly before he unfortunately died, and he had a list of things he never wanted to hear again. Okay? And if you want to know more about that, I'll let you know. That's where I get the idea. So the first thing is, and these are two related points, I call the first one, can't make it up in volume. You know the joke, oh no, we're selling at a loss? Hey, don't worry, we'll make it up in volume. Okay? If you have an interpretation that has deep problems, don't pretend that you can paper them over by just putting on epicycles. A related problem I call getting blood from a stone. Our interpretation is so simple and the math is so straightforward we barely need any axioms. Many worlds interpretation, I'm shaking my finger at you. Except for these eight obvious principles from decision theory, cosmology, anthropic principles, so forth. Look, you all know, you know, you cannot pull axioms out of thin air. And you can't bury a lack of axioms under, you know, decision theory or whatever, like burying a toxic asset under complex financial instruments. We all know what happened when we did that. And some of those were trained as physicists, too, which makes me a little mad. Right, an example, which you all know from Hume, you can't hand wave an ought from an is, but you also can't hand wave a probability from an is either. So be honest up front about your axioms and how they compare to other choices you could have made in other interpretations. I've addressed this point a couple of times, but this is the notion of measure zero assumptions. I'll ask you, please don't build an interpretation or basic principles on top of unphysical, infinitely idealized measure zero assumptions at a fundamental level. Idealized assumptions are fine when you're doing practical calculations or constraining a theory. By the level of interpretations, if I do an infinitely small perturbation to one of these assumptions and the theory and the interpretation stops working, that's a problem. Okay? And this is especially bad if those perturbations are really always present. In particular, if the interpretation being presented does not involve wave function collapse, so entanglements never break, then you can't start a paper with state vectors, wave functions, or the Schrodinger equation as foundational statements. Because no system has those things, except maybe the universe as a whole. On a related point, don't blithely assume a universe as a whole. I call this the Russian doll problem. In practice, when you look at realistic systems, and as you consider systems of increasing scope, they become more entangled, and their dynamics becomes more nonlinear in an exponentially rapid way due to correlations and entanglement. And there is no evidence that if you continue this on forever, the process just truncates with a perfectly pure closed system. Even linear dynamics, not even unitary dynamics, is an unphysical idealization. And without that assumption, if you have a system that's sufficiently badly behaved, it's very nonlinear, there's no theorem that guarantees you can embed it in a system that is evolving linearly, let alone unitarily. There's a related point here. This is a question about unitarity being treated as a fundamental axiom, so I really want to push this. So many principles in physics that were once thought to be fundamental postulates are now understood to be approximate consequences of deeper a priori axioms or principles. These are still useful idealizations for calculations and constraining theories. A great example is energy conservation. Very useful, mechanics, lots of other areas. But it's not a fundamental principle. It follows from certain assumptions like time symmetry of the dynamics. Does not hold the level of the entire universe in an expanding universe like our own. There's no global time symmetry. The fancy way that people in general relativity say this is that our expanding universe does not have an asymptotically time-like killing vector, but it's a fancy way of saying there's not a global time symmetry. There isn't even an energy well-defined, let alone one that's conserved. Unitarity and quantum theory are surprisingly similar. Very useful for practical calculations, very useful for constraining, for example, theories of particle physics, discovering, for example, the W and Z bosons because there was a lack of unitarity in the interactions of neutrinos. But again, unitarity follows from assumptions that your system is exactly information closed, which is just never true for any realistic system. Maybe not even for the universe, maybe, maybe not. Again, if there exists just one sufficiently badly behaved system in the universe, I call this the quantum Russell's teapot, somewhere there's a teapot floating around Saturn that's behaving in a really badly nonlinear way, then you simply cannot fit it into a universe evolving linearly, let alone unitarily. So don't assume it's uncontroversial to pretend that unitarity or even linear dynamics is a freestanding foundational principle. Now, this is a problem I don't actually see among philosophers very much, but I do see this in textbooks among physicists, who still say that the measuring problem is how can we reconcile the fact that an unmeasured system evolves smoothly whereas a system being measured evolves in some discontinuous stochastic way. That version of that statement of the problem has been solved. been solved classically. Classically closed systems, just like quantum systems, evolve, if you assume determinism, they evolve smoothly and unitarily. But a classical open system generally evolves nonlinearly, abruptly, and stochastically. You're averaging over interactions with a larger environment. True in quantum mechanics as well. In quantum theory in particular, decoherence ensures that at the end of a measurement, the post-measurement reduced density matrix, that is the thing encoding the final probabilities, mathematically looks like you'd expect for the classical probability distribution following the measurement. Okay, so that part is okay. The real problem is that, for example, in decoherence, that density matrix you get, which looks like the probability distribution you expect classically, is not really a classical probability distribution. The final outcomes are not classically belonging to an ensemble. The impurity, the lack of being pure in the reduced density matrix is a result of entanglement, which has no classical analog. And we really can't say, at least naively, that the system has a definite state. So these are not to be confused with proper mixtures, which are just impurity, I don't know the exact state, just a classical uncertainty. Decoherence does not solve this problem. It just doesn't solve it. It doesn't solve this. And related to this, at the end of the day, if I'm doing a measurement, something comes out. Does the system I was measuring, do I as an observer as a system have a state? Is there a sample space for us? I would argue that every interpretation should take a stand here. So I've been to too many talks where you begin with, for simplicity, we consider just the non-relativistic case. Okay, this is a cop-out. Successful interpretations of non-relativistic quantum theory are a dime a dozen at this point. They're like mousetraps. The patent office will tell you, people keep inventing and trying to patent mousetraps. The ones we have work, we don't need anymore. Or it's like curing cancer in lab mice. It's been done many times over, but frequently it doesn't translate to humans. What is it about mice in all these examples? Okay. Relativity has presented an obstruction, an obstacle to interpretations of quantum theory for nearly a century. If your interpretation doesn't address relativity in a substantive way, I don't mean solve everything, but at least address it, please let me know in advance. And this is where I'm going to end, and this brings it full circle to this larger question, that maybe the traditional starting place is at the wrong level. The minimal modal interpretation is most naturally formulated with this beautiful analogy between the classical and quantum pictures, where we can really see the spectral resolution of the probability random variable helping us single things out. And maybe this is a lesson that state vectors, wave function, Hilbert spaces, Schrodinger equation, etc., which, by the way, are not general enough to handle open systems anyway, are maybe not the right place to start for understanding, interpreting, and maybe even teaching quantum theory. Perhaps this was just an historical accident, a red herring. Dirac's seminal book in 1930, the first edition of Principles of Quantum Mechanics, and if you haven't read it, it's a beautiful book. It's written with just beautiful language. It was just ecstasy to read it. Established what we now think of as the traditional undergraduate version of quantum theory. Right? Interestingly, this was 3 years before Kolmogorov presented his formulation of probability theory in the modern way. I found a book from 1925 by a Harvard math professor in probability theory. Could not look more different from the picture of Kolmogorov. No sample spaces, certainly no random variables. In fact, random variables in information theory didn't arise for decades after that. Quantum mechanics is really old. It predates some notions that we often think of as being prior notions. And maybe it's time to rethink the traditional starting place. Thank you.